I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. This is part two of our interview with Glenn Kelman.
Well, there's a huge migration from coastal cities inland. It's almost a reversal of the classic American tale about the wrath of grapes, or the grapes of wrath. I said it in reverse, which is sort of ironic because that's the process we're talking about now, where people are leaving really expensive cities because wages have not kept up with home prices.
Redfin CEO. Glenn, in part one, we talked a lot about humility and some other things. Question I'm really interested in is patience. You know, running the business for 10 years before IPOing, and especially in the kind of microwave culture we have today, sometimes where it feels like people want stuff as long as it's fast, cheap, and easy, right?
Yeah.
Spending a solid decade like that in that startup phase is not something a lot of people necessarily stick with, it seems like, these days. Can you talk about, you know, patience as a virtue, patience as a competitive advantage, anything like that?
Every overnight success is 10 years in the making. And I think that sometimes people just don't realize that because they only see the cake when it comes out of the oven. My good fortune was that I started Plumtree, an enterprise software company that went public in 2002, and then had a period of about 12 months where I wasn't working in an office. And I was so blue. In between Plumtree and Redfin, I just didn't know what to do with myself. I missed the team and the mission, and I didn't have anywhere to go, and I didn't know whether to shave or even get dressed. And people assumed that I was kite surfing in Brazil or learning Japanese, but really, I had found my passion, and all I wanted to do was get back in the game, to find a way to be at my best. And so now I tell myself about this job that they shoot horses, don't they? And what that means is that one day I'll be too old, I won't be entrepreneurial, I won't have the ideas or the energy, and someone else should run Redfin. And that'll be a sad day for me. So I used to think about, when will this end, when I started Plumtree with some friends. And now I think about, how can I keep going? But the key to that is you've got to do something worthwhile. If we were making software for dentist offices or selling chocolate chip cookies over the web, well, I couldn't be done with that fast enough. But helping people whose lives are in transition, figuring out a third of the U.S. economy and making it more efficient, I decided that's actually worth a good chunk of my life. And at the end of that run, I won't feel like it was time poorly spent. And what I've noticed is that people always want what they don't have. When you're this rinky-dink little startup, you can't wait to get all grown up one day. And then after you go public, people are nostalgic for the good old days, and they forget that we were worried we weren't going to make payroll and that we were snappy with each other because it was so much stress. And I just try to enjoy the moment because I think Redfin's better than ever. And it's just human nature not to see that.
You know, it's interesting how as humans we actually get the choice to look at it the way we want to look at it. But if you don't intentionally choose, the default view is typically not the one you're talking about, right?
Yeah, it's either things are going to get better or they were so great last year. And I'm lucky because I was here last year and the year before that. And when one Redfin old timer says to another, remember the good old days? I'll say, oh, are you talking about the great financial crisis of 2008 or 2010? when 42 VC said no, or 2011 when we were all about to kill each other. I mean, those were tough times too. And they just get edited out. They get edited out in the official narrative, but also in your brain.
Yeah.
It's always hard. And if it weren't hard, you'd be bored.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, because startups are hard and also exhilarating. When you think about, you know, because I understand Stanford Technology Group was Sequoia backed, right? And then you went to Plumtree in this. What do you feel like the advantages are going into Redfin, having this your experience from Stanford Technology Group and Plumtree?
Well, the first advantage is that I'd seen the shiitake mushrooms hit the fan. At Plumtree, it was a dot-com boom until it was a bust. We went into a board meeting where everyone had been telling us to hire more and grow faster, and all of a sudden it was, what were you thinking? And that prepared me for the ups and downs of Redfin. You know, we went through this great financial crisis. We laid off 20% of the workforce. Everyone wrote us off. But I'd lived to tell the tale before, and I was able to stand up in front of the company and say, look, I did a layoff like this before, and that company went public, and I'm not guaranteeing that'll happen this time, but I know it can happen. And I think what's more important is that you have to have a narrative that's not just about making money. There has to be a sense of purpose in your life. They've studied families, and it turns out that families that have a narrative of rising and families that have a narrative of decline, neither of those do as well as families that have a narrative of ups and downs. This family has been through a hard time. Your dad delivered flowers. Your mom cleaned hotel rooms. But we've always stuck together, and we've always done what we believed was right. Those families raise the best kids. And so if your only narrative running a startup is we're going to kill it, well, the day you don't is the day everybody stops listening to you. But if your narrative is that we're fundamentally doing a good thing, and sometimes the market's going to reward that, and sometimes we're going to screw it up, we're going to keep doing a good thing. Because usually when people work hard to do a good thing, especially if they're building technology to do that, society rewards that. And you just have to keep working hard at it. And what drives me crazy about a lot of these narratives is they have this model that I don't think actually fits reality. I don't know if you've ever seen Die Hard, but they're drilling through this safe at Nakatomi Plaza, and there's six or seven walls, but the last shield is electromagnetic, and they don't know how they're going to get through that shield. And then the FBI cuts the power to the entire neighborhood, and you see these guys running into the vault, grabbing bags of money and throwing it around. And I always felt like I understood the drilling part, but not the electromagnetic part, that there would be this magic moment where we would go from being zeros to heroes. But instead, it happens so gradually that I still don't feel like a hero, and I don't quite feel like a zero. I just kept drilling, and I just kept waiting for the fairy dust to be sprinkled on us that made us cool. And instead, I think it's just a lot of hard work.
Yeah. You know, thinking about that hard work and paying attention and having an opinion about things, I'm interested in your thoughts on the real estate market. You guys have such unique data because of the nature of your approach to things. As you think about the next couple of years, what do you think maybe not everybody is seeing?
Well, there's a huge migration from coastal cities inland. It's almost a reversal of the classic American tale about the wrath of grapes, or the grapes of wrath. I said it in reverse, which is sort of ironic because that's the process we're talking about now, where people are leaving really expensive cities because wages have not kept up with home prices because of tax reform and for other reasons. And they're moving to America's forgotten places, which I think is really good because the last major election was really a referendum on how there's two Americas, and there shouldn't be. There shouldn't be this incredibly opulent coast and this interior wasteland. I'm trying to remember the word our president used. No, carnage was the word that he used. I know that's strong, but there shouldn't be two economies. There should be one. When we have airplanes and internet connections and highways and trains, talent should go to the place where people can afford to live. And so I think that's been the fundamental narrative. And then the second part of it is that homeownership rates are going to decline in America. That's been a long-term trend, and it's because there isn't a broad consensus. And it's not just the mortgage interest deduction, which is a fairly regressive tax break. It's cities deciding that they want to work with developers and building transit and roads. The compact that we had at the end of World War II to house this greatest generation of people who fought in these world wars just doesn't exist right now. There's so much student debt and so little new construction and so much suspicion of developers that I think we should just expect that homeownership rates are going to decline. In a way, it's a perverse consequence of sort of Obama-era tax reforms, which were credit reforms, which were very well-intentioned, but which just prevented about half of America from getting the credit to buy a house without replacing that with some other kind of subsidy, because there just wasn't the political will between the left and the right to do that. So I think you won't see as many people investing in the American dream.
Interesting. Do you see that relating or having effect on the different investor grade real estate assets, whether that's, you know, commercial or industrial or multifamily?
Yeah, well, I think we're going to have this landlord nation where if more people are going to rent, fewer people are going to own, you're going to see a concentration of home ownership. And there are Wall Street firms that are buying up Main Street. There are people doing that at a local level with Airbnb, where they buy three or four places and rent them out. So my guess is that you're going to see more people becoming tiny property barons. That's a good opportunity for those folks. But I'd prefer to see everyone own his own home, you know, a chicken in every pot, things like that.
Yeah. Well, listen, thanks for your time here. To wrap up, maybe tell us a book that's had a big influence on you or a book you'd recommend for the rest of us.
Interesting question. Well, the last two books that have really affected me are not business books. I really like Pachinko, which is a novel about Koreans living in Japan over many generations. And in general, I recommend novels because I think most people know the basics of running a business, spend less than your revenues. But what we really need to do is be able to imagine what it's like to be different people on our teams, to be different types of customers. And novels help me do that. And then I read The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer, which won a Pulitzer Prize. It's this amazing account of how we cured cancer. And what I took from that was for the longest time, we cut bigger and bigger hunks out of people thinking that had to be the right way to do it. And it was because we believed in ideas so much, we ignored the data that really large mastectomies and other types of surgeries didn't work as well as a combination of a lot of little different things, chemotherapy and radiation and surgery together. And it's my distrust of ideology and this idea that the data will tell you something if you listen to it, that has humbled me in the way we talked about at the outset of the show.
I love it. Well, thanks again for making time for us.
Thank you. Take care.
You bet. Well, that's it for the episode. One other thing I wanted to tell you about. If you'll remember the guys from Convoy in episodes back, Ken Free and Trent Mano, I went on one of their CEO trips to New York and I met a guy named Brent Thompson. Very successful entrepreneur. He was former CEO of Jive Communications, big company now, I think $300 or $400 million. Anyways, he started a new company called blipbillboards.com. I'm super stoked they're a sponsor now. But I remember a year and some ago when I met him, I thought it was genius. Instead of having to buy 6 months or a year's worth of billboard for thousands of dollars, you can buy 8 seconds at a time for like 10 or 20 cents. You pick what billboard you want it on, what time of day you want it to run. And it just puts so much power in the hands of marketers and CEOs who want to try something and see if it works. You can buy as many or as few as you want, change it as many times as you want. I think now our podcast is being advertised on billboards in like 18 different states because we have these guys as sponsors. We're pretty excited about it. Hope you check out blipbillboards.com. Thanks.